David is referred to or mentioned almost 1,000 times in Scripture. Therefore, I think we're not misfocused in exploring his life during this summer season to tell his story. On this Father's Day, I don't want you to miss Jesse. Jesse's house is the house that the prophet Samuel went to when he was looking to anoint a new king over Israel. David most likely reflected some of the core values of his family and instilled in this younger son, maybe a little further along than his older brothers, were some spiritual principles that are worth referring to. And so I think we can safely infer that Jesse cared for his sons, conducted the affairs of his family related to God's house, to the Spirit of God in leading the people of Israel, and that he was a godly man. Doesn't mean that he was perfect. I don't think if I asked the men today to raise their hand if they were a perfect father that we would get a single person who could do that. I know I certainly could not. The story is quite intriguing as we think about this continuing faith of David and the need of the bigger picture, especially as related to King Saul. There's a King Saul in all of our lives. Maybe not a person named King Saul, but there are circumstances that every single one of us deal with that are beyond our control, that we may just kind of stumble into, that is very painful, that is not necessarily easily solved, and that we struggle with. All of us are needy persons, but God places his arms around all of us and brings us around his table. Saul, who was then king of Israel, was in trouble. The foundation of his life was not what it needed to be in order to be a king. And we all know about folks who kind of reach their edge of the gifts and tools and beliefs and faith that they have, and then they just can't go any further. And that's where Saul found himself. An evil spirit came upon him. Those words need to be unpacked a bit, and I have to spend a moment or two doing just that. This is an old story, over 2,000 years old. We have a little better language to describe both spiritual and psychological malaise that come in our lives, but the words evil spirit is not out of bounds for us, I don't think. I have an evil spirit occasionally that dominates my thinking. You know, I can be angry and jealous and fearful and paranoid. You know, there are a voice that comes to me sometimes that says, when I'm trying to do my best, you know, and I'm pushing myself, that says to me, Paul, who do you think you are? And why do you think God should give you this victory or allow you to do this? All of us have those spirits that come that sometimes depresses us and robs us of our joy and causes us to begin to think of ourselves as the master of our lives, and our ambitions just take over us. And we say, you know, doesn't matter who I step on, you know, I'm going to get what I want because I deserve it, you know. And so we know about that spirit that comes on us. We use different psychological and spiritual language today, but all of us know of that side of ourselves. And the danger of it is sometimes it can get so strong and out of bounds within our lives that it can take us over. And boy, to wrestle spiritual control and strength back from that kind of struggle is really, really hard. We all know what it's like to wrestle with those spirits that are within our soul. It might not be the way we would express it today, but we know very well in our lives that spirit that emerges in us that is not our best selves and is not a self that surrenders completely to God and says, God, I am your servant, and come take over my life and take over my family and my marriage and my work life and my social life, my spiritual life. We know what it's like to wrestle back. And so that's where Saul finds himself. wrestling with all of those fears and paranoia and not feeling that he's adequate and not having, you know, just kind of making things worse for himself. And that's what happens when this wrong kind of spirit takes over our lives. And so often we blame God when the fact is it's not God that's doing this. We're doing it to ourselves. I'll kind of chuckle when people say, talk about breaking the Ten Commandments. You can't break the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are the Ten Commandments. They'll never be broken. You can break yourself on the Ten Commandments, but you're not going to break one of the commandments because they're from the voice of God and they are what they are. So we tend to think too highly of ourselves that we are the master of everything, and we're not. We break ourselves when we break those commandments. We don't break the commandments. It's still healthy. We are real unhealthy at that point. And that's where Saul finds himself. We know about that struggle, and as we think about how does it get dealt with in this story? Well, Saul's handlers are trying to manage him. We know about handlers in life. All of us have some handlers, people who advise us, parents who are a part of our lives and nurturing and caring for us. Generally, none of us walk alone. They are handlers. Often, we are only as good as our handlers, so be careful. Who you choose as your friends and who you associate with. And so the handlers get this idea, Saul is suffering, we got to do something, what do we do? So they decide, well, good music is good for the soul. And so they go and they recruit David to come and play the lyre or this miniature harp in Saul's presence to calm his spirit. Music has a way of getting behind the hard core of our lives. We have a lot of music and singing at Cokesbury because music, we believe, allows you to offer to God what you want to give to God, but you're unable to do so unless the spirit and the mood is there to allow you to relax and let God into places that God won't get to except through good music. These musicians and worship leaders are really great therapists. If you had to pay them, you probably couldn't write the check for the good that they do. So I hope they think highly of themselves and know how highly we think of them. But there is tremendous therapy in music. We've known that for thousands and thousands of years. Psychology Today, a couple editions back, had an article about an English hospital that was near a church. Church was part of the complex. And the English doctors discovered that the ward or the wing of the hospital that fronted the church or the chapel, that people tended to heal quicker, and there was a completely different mood in that wing of the hospital. And it's one that when people came back to the hospital, they would ask for, and they couldn't understand it. What they came to understand is that the music from the chapel services that the patients heard and the rehearsals as well, that it made people more communicative, it made them more sociable, and it was the medicine for the soul that they needed. For far too long, medicine has been practiced in our society as kind of this sterile discipline that doesn't always include the emotions and the spirit as well. And really true healing can't happen unless all of the dimensions of our life are addressed. And so today even the VA is making such strides in worshiping or in ministering to our wounded warriors, that dimension of aesthetics and music and outdoor spaces within our lives. And so this was some elementary beginnings of understanding of how healing can come to the human soul. Music brings light and lift into our lives. Good music is therapeutic and healing. Music has another dimension also that can be very detrimental in life and unhealthy, but there is that spiritual dimension that's beautiful and powerful. Stephen Furtick tells of growing up in his youth group in his church, and he said every Halloween they would have a horror house that the youth would put on in order to raise money for their choir tour. And he says it was just a lot of fun. It was just a lot of crazy kids in costumes and masks, and they would rent a warehouse and you know, decorate it with tacky furniture and corridors, and people would pay to come in and be scared. There's something about us that likes to occasionally be scared and fearful and uncertain. And he said it was a win-win situation. We made money, and they had their fun of being scared and seeing us and running away screaming. And it was a fun way to raise money for a noble project. But he said in the evenings, when the hours were over, for the house of horror, he said they would turn on the lights. And he said, I'll never forget looking around in the darkness. He said the mask came off and you could see the costumes and the tacky furnishings. And he said what seemed so fearful to so many earlier was just a bunch of kids who were having fun and making a little money, and there wasn't anything really to be frightened of. So it is when music allows us to have that window of light that comes into our lives. And what seems so fearful and overwhelming, and just when we feel so desperate about things, all of a sudden we say, you know, what scared us and frightened us and hurt us may not have completely gone away. But in the light of music, in the light of God, in the light of the Spirit of the Lord, it looks totally different. It looks so tame to what it looked just a short time ago. My goodness, how many people struggle with their therapists and struggle with their lives in that darkness where things just seem to be so overwhelming, where they are panicked and they are fearful and they are crushed. And then that shaft of light from the gift of God that comes from so many different directions enters one's life. And all of a sudden, we're not afraid any longer. We're not overwhelmed. We don't have to be. Not only, I'm sure, did David play his harp for Saul to calm Saul's heart, but I'm sure he also quoted some of his psalms as well. He must have been working on the 23rd Psalm as quite a young man. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. And Saul couldn't get to the green pastures. Saul couldn't get to the green pastures. And yet David knew about them, and he refreshed his soul in them, because the Lord, who was the good shepherd, took him there. And he knew you couldn't get there without the Lord. That's why people need the Lord. That's why people need the church. That's why people need Christ. Why we need Christ as at the center of our families. Because what seems so overwhelming to us, and rightfully so, often there will be a shaft of light. There will be a blessing of music. There will be a new song and a new tune that can only come from God, that can change the situation. The dark night of the soul is so much a prevalent part of our nation right now as we deal with the opiate epidemic. And much of that epidemic comes from the pain, physical pain, that so many people deal with. And perhaps the over-prescription of pills when there is just the disparate need for help and for healing. But you know, such a big percentage of that comes from people who are not experiencing physical pain. They're experiencing the pain of their soul, where they are grappling just like Saul in the darkness. And there's got to be some relief, some way to help me make it through the night. And so as we gather as a Christian family and talk about David and his life, it's very much like the world in which we live, where there is a whole lot of pain out there, and where people are looking for the light and the music and the song and the faith and the hope and something to hold on to. And David did his very best all through his life to proclaim that the Lord God Yahweh was able, that there was a God in Israel who had the power to save. There was a God in Israel who had the strength to give to those who might not find an immediate solution to what they're wrestling with, but there was ability to tie the knot, the proverbial knot in the rope, and to hang on and to see what surprise God might have next. And it's a powerful and beautiful story. There was an opportunity in this story for us to understand the healing that's needed in our own families. I have enjoyed Pat Conroy, who wrote The Prince of Tides. It came at a great time in my life with my South Carolina connections. And You may remember Barbara Streisand and Nick Nolte in the film. Read the book before you see the movie. Movies have a way of corrupting books, and that movie was a real corruption of what was actually written. So read the book first. But the story of the South Carolina family, in which there was a lot of pain, and some really powerful quotes in that book. He says about this family there in the tidal area of South Carolina, he says, in my parents' battle with one another, the only prisoners they ever took in that battle were their children. And it's an unfolding of the woundedness of that family. But there's a shaft of light and hope in that book that starts at the very beginning, when the three children would run to the end of the pier and jump off together. And as they immersed themselves under the water, they would join hands. And Pat Connery talks about that family unity as a unity of blood and spirit and family. And for a moment, they would be cut off from the outside world, and they would be this nurturing peace in their lives. And it was from that image and that experience that when he was called to go to New York to be with his sister who had attempted to take her life, that he begins to reconnect with what it means to be family and what it means to know that peace of another world that they could only know when they were immersed in the water of the bay and the world was up here, but there was a moment that they were sheltered. And he knew enough about that peace and that shelter that it was a part of life that was real. It wasn't just a fantasy. But how in the world could he get there was his plea. Pat has some wonderful statements, and one of them that I wanted to close with is what he says about fathering. He said, "My own father would have been a great father if he had not been so violent," as he talks about his father and his trying to stay in his dad's life and nurture him. But this is what he says about fathers to their sons and daughters. Teach them very well. Teach them the quiet verbs of kindness, to live beyond themselves. Urge them towards excellence. Drive them towards gentleness. Pull them upward towards manhood and womanhood, but softly, like an angel arranging a cloud. You know, so often we want to muscle our way in family, and I love those closing words, which is an indictment on me, Mr. Organization, you know, Mr. Being on Time, Mr., you know, let's take 2 minutes, handle this, shelve it, forget about it. But softly do the work of family, like an angel arranging a cloud. A friend of mine's son was going on a choir tour out west, and the dad, the friend, said to his son, early teenager, "Son, here's $7 a day." This was some years ago. $7 a day for your expenses, your noon meal, snacks, drinks, whatever, and you're to spend it $7 a day, and you won't run out of money. And so this was a teaching moment for this dad. About halfway through the trip, in talking with the counselors and so forth, he finds out his son has run out of money. And so, of course, he's angry and upset, knows his son didn't listen to him, and so he makes arrangements for, you know, other resources to be made available to his son. His son gets back off the bus, and they're talking after the trip. And finally, the moment comes for the father and son moment. And the son gets off the bus at the end of the trip with this statue of an Indian with his bow pulled, white, Pastor Paris, ugly statue. His dad wonders, why in the world did he buy that? It's ridiculous. And then he talks to his son. "Son, I told you, $7 a day, precisely how much you had to spend. And here I find out that just a few days into the trip, you have spent all of your money. Don't you ever listen to me, you know. Don't you believe what I tell you. How in the world could you have done this? And you know I made arrangements for other money to be provided for you." And the son said, "You know, I know I spent all the money, but I really didn't, you know, I really didn't miss that noon meal. And, you know, everywhere we went, there was always plenty of water to drink. And I, you know, I didn't need that extra money. I didn't need any money. I was satisfied. Everything was fine. Why why are you so worried? And the father dogmatically goes over the spending plan and the instructions and how disappointed he is. And then he says, and what do you have to say for yourself? And what are you doing with this ridiculous statue with you? And his son says, Dad, I bought this statue for you because I knew I'd be coming back on Father's Day. And I wanted you to have it. Happy Father's Day. Dad, here's your gift. Kind of a parable of Father's Day, isn't it? Kind of the difficulty of it. We try our very best, but sometimes there's something about that light, that work of God that's working there kind of underneath the surface that, friends, we really need. We really need in family. Friends, we don't have to do it all by ourselves. David didn't do it all by himself. Jesse didn't do it all by himself. The nation didn't do it all by themselves, but they relied on God. So if you haven't made a decision to make Jesus Christ the center of your family, I hope you will. The center of your marriage, the center of your work life, the center of your life, period. Because David made God the center of his life. And God, through trial and error and struggle and ups and downs, as we're going to find out with David, God made something beautiful of David, made something beautiful for us, in that he shows us a man and a story where we can say, this was a man after the heart of God. I want to be more like him. I hope you want to be more like David, as well as more like Jesus Christ.